What's next for corporate America as earnings season gets underway?
And the head of the Olympics wonders aloud whether McDonald's is quite the right sponsor. Hey, everybody, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. It is Monday, the 9th of July. And coming up, we're going to talk about what all of that heat and dry weather is doing to the nation's crops and the effect that that could have on food prices.
And along with the Olympics McDonald's flap, some other Olympic news. Apparently, folks who live in London in certain apartment buildings are a little upset that the government plans to put anti-aircraft batteries on their roofs. So we'll talk to a BBC correspondent about that one. Plenty more coming up as well on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Well, let's start with some of the market news that we've been watching this morning.
A third official has quit the new government in Greece. This time it's the deputy labor minister. Greece, of course, is saddled with a harsh austerity program as a condition of its bailout from the rest of the eurozone. And the minister, who's got such a wonderful name, we'd love to be able to say it over and over, but he's gone now. Nikos Nikolopoulos says the new government was not pushing hard enough to get a better deal for Greece from Europe.
Well, meanwhile, in Europe's fourth largest economy, the yield on Spanish 10-year bonds is sitting in the danger zone today, above 7%. With that kind of pressure, European finance ministers said today the country will get an extra year to meet its own austerity targets.
A little bit of merger news this morning. The giant health insurer WellPoint is buying rival Amerigroup, and the big attraction is Medicaid. This deal would not have happened 2 weeks ago, but following the Supreme Court's decision on the Affordable Care Act, WellPoint is banking on lots more people getting insured under the joint state-federal program. After the merger, the two insurers together are going to serve 4.5 million Medicaid patients.
It's amazing how fast business takes place right after a big decision like that.
We're waiting for it, I guess.
Well, and Boeing has just announced an order this morning for $7 billion worth of its new fuel-efficient 737 MAX aircraft. And Campbell Soup Company is buying a company called Bolthouse Farms for $1.5 billion. That company sells carrots, juice, and salad dressing.
And finally, the aluminum producer Alcoa announces its latest earnings after the close of markets today. Alcoa has the honor, if you can call it that, of kicking off the round of earnings announcements every quarter.
And we're going to hear about that now from Michelle Gerard. She is senior U.S. economist with RBS, and she's with us from Stamford, Connecticut. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, Michelle, what are you expecting from corporate America this season?
Well, you know, they've really guided our expectations lower. We're not expecting it to be a very upbeat earnings season. I have to say, I fear that the numbers may be somewhat disappointing. Part of it is a stronger dollar, which actually hurts companies that are bringing earnings back from overseas that have to get translated back into dollars. But let's face it, we are looking at a much softer economic environment, and I think that explains why this particular quarter of earnings could be disappointing.
Well, why are we going to see another one of these years where we had a spring slowdown, but then things get better in the summer?
That's exactly been the pattern in each of the last 3 years. We've come into the year with a lot of strength, lost momentum in the spring, but then reaccelerated in the second half of the year. Unfortunately, I don't think that that's likely to play out this year. You know, the biggest factor I think that's going to work against growth here in the U.S. in the second half of this year is the uncertainty over our own fiscal situation. And as we've talked about, the uncertainty over Europe obviously has been a factor behind the spring slowdown, but now we have so many unanswered questions. Are the tax rates going to go up at year-end? Are the spending cuts going to be put in place? People talk about the so-called fiscal cliff maybe pushing us to the brink of recession. I mean, against all of that uncertainty, you can understand why businesses may stay sidelined until at least the outcome of the November elections and they have more clarity on where the economy is going.
Michelle Gerard, senior U.S. economist at RBS, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Jeff, we mentioned the heat a moment ago. It is finally sort of gone here in New York. I think it's only supposed to be in the mid-80s today. But in a lot of the country, the effects have lingered, and it's been a long drought for farmers, being called the worst in decades. Here is Marketplace's David Gura.
It's been hot in Sydney, Iowa for weeks now. That's where Daryl McAlexander farms corn and soybeans. Today, it's supposed to be 85 degrees there.
The temperatures are just a little bit cooler, but we still need rain.
McAlexander hasn't given up. He says the plants he grows today are hardier than the ones he used to grow. But McAlexander's optimism is starting to fade.
probably we're looking at a reduction of somewhere around 30 to 40% in our yield.
That's the case across the Midwest. Fred Belo is a plant biologist at the University of Illinois in Urbana.
We're at half the rainfall that we would normally have. We never recharged the soil from a dry winter, and so we were really needing these timely rains in order to get the crop along, and we just simply haven't had it.
Right now is when corn is supposed to be pollinating. Corrine Alexander talks to farmers in Indiana regularly. She's an agricultural economist at Purdue.
Some of them, especially if they're on sandy soils, which don't hold any moisture, they've already given up their crop. They're plowing it under and they're turning to their crop insurance if they have crop insurance.
And Alexander says analysts are comparing this drought to a big one back in 1988.
Which resulted in huge, huge losses in yields for both corn and soybeans.
I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Well, the trouble on the farm is likely to have implications around the world. And for that part of the story, let's bring in Nick Higgins. He's a commodity analyst at Rabobank International in London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, we've heard that this drought is the worst since the 80s. How bad is it in your view?
Look, it's terrible. In fact, I mean, the U.S. is still the world's largest producer of corn. This has hit the corn complex particularly hard, where we see global corn exports of around 100 million tons. Versus current U.S. government estimates, we think that 50 million tons has been lost from the U.S. crop.
What are the implications on things like meat prices? Because obviously corn is used to feed livestock.
That's exactly right. We get mixed implications in the first place. First of all, the higher corn prices will suggest that people are less willing to put their cattle on feed. If it gets very bad, they'll liquidate their herd, not even bothering to finish them off ready for supermarkets and the like. So that's what I think we'll see coming next, you know, the size of the U.S. cattle herd coming down, and then that will push up prices following.
Is there anything that can be done at this point?
Not really. Farmers are always at the mercy of the weather. So what can be done is relatively little. I mean, market forces will work, and we'll see higher prices across the complex, which will stop, I suppose, some people from eating meat, and there'll be less cattle around and probably slightly less ethanol produced as well. And that will allow the U.S. to keep exporting, probably at a slightly lower pace, and the whole sort of grains balance sheet of the world will have to re-equilibrate.
Nick Higgins is a commodity analyst at Rabobank International. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Cheers. Thank you.
International Olympic Committee President Jacques Roga is in kind of a sticky spot. The Financial Times asked him whether he sees any problem with having McDonald's and Coke sponsor what is the world's biggest exposition of physical fitness. So what I would expect here, Jeremy, is that an official would finesse some sort of non-answer to that question. It's a pretty delicate point. But he basically said, oh, well, yeah, kind of. That bothers us a little bit. And Marketplace's Stephen Beard is here with more on that story. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So is Roga saying that he regrets allowing McDonald's to sponsor the Games?
No, but he's clearly not 100% happy about it. He said it wasn't an easy decision because of the global obesity crisis. But in the end, he said his first priority is the Olympic movement. And he says they need the cash to ensure the survival of Olympic sports and some national Olympic teams.
And just how much cash are we talking about here?
Well, we don't have an exact breakdown. The 11 global sponsors have so far stumped up around $1 billion between them. That figure, though, is dwarfed by the broadcasting rights, which have so far raised about $4 billion from these games.
McDonald's has sponsored the Olympics for, I gather, 36 years now. This seems like a pretty essential contradiction between athletics and fatty foods. Why is this coming up now?
Well, it's, I think, because it's becoming more of an issue now as the obesity crisis worsens. And there are more health groups campaigning now on this issue. And they've been critical of the McDonald's sponsorship. Tam Fry of Britain's National Obesity Forum claims McDonald's mostly sells an unhealthy product and should not be associated with the Games.
The Olympics is such a jewel that the sponsorship of that jewel should come from companies that have a really very high profile attitude towards health and nutrition. And I would not give McDonald's the credit for that.
In a statement, McDonald said obesity is a complex issue and ultimately it's up to individuals to make the right choice.
Stephen Beard in London, thanks very much.
Okay, Jeff.
In other Olympics news, residents of some apartment buildings are upset, can't imagine why, that the British military plans to put anti-aircraft weapons on their roofs. Hmm. The tenants of the Fred Wigg Tower in East London, one of the apartment buildings involved, they've gone to court, and they say the Ministry of Defense did not properly consult them before deciding to mount missiles on their buildings. Rob Broomby is the British Affairs correspondent for the BBC, and he joins me from London. Hello.
Hi, Jeff.
First of all, why does the British military need surface-to-air missiles on the roof of apartment buildings?
Well, a city like London, as you would imagine, already has substantial air defences for normal times. But the view is that during the Olympic period, they need to be absolutely sure that those Olympic venues are safe, but also to send a message both to the public that they're doing everything necessary to protect the people of London and the people visiting the Olympics, but also to send out a warning, if you like, to any potential plotters that these things are in place and any airborne threats will be very severely dealt with.
Why would these particular buildings have been chosen?
Largely because of the line of sight that they have, the splendid views over the Olympic sites, particularly the airspace surrounding those. This is all a part of a very large series of programs put in place, defense in depth, if you like, one after the other.
I'm sure the folks in these buildings are wondering, though, why us specifically, and what are the concerns, what's the scenario that they fear here?
Well, as I say, the main one is simply that they fear by having a military establishment on their roof, if you like, they become a target themselves for would-be terrorists who might, for instance, I don't know, plant a car bomb outside in the street. There's also an additional fear that if these missiles were launched, they've claimed in court this morning that parts could fly off, set fire to buildings, etc. Now, I have to say, the Ministry of Defence is speaking in court this morning, have said that there is no credible terror threat to the blocks and no risk of an accident, and that these decisions have been taken at the highest level with proper consideration.
The BBC's Rob Broomby in London. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
About a month ago, the Federal Election Commission approved a proposal to allow campaign contributions via text message. But now Reuters is reporting today that wireless carriers in the country might not be so easy to convince.
Here to talk with us in today's Midday Extra is Scott Thomas of the law firm Dickstein Shapiro. He's a former Federal Election Commission chairman. Hi, Scott.
How are you?
Doing well. So why would the wireless carriers be against this idea?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. I suppose there are several reasons. There are concerns, I suppose, about just the hassle. I mean, for a carrier to keep track of all of the accounting and the passing along of money. And also, they have expressed some concerns about liability. You know, who's going to be responsible for making sure these people who give money via text messaging are complying with contribution limits. I think they want to get those kinds of issues settled a little bit before they jump in.
People have been making charitable contributions through text message for a while. You know, we see the sort of Haiti relief telethons, and they always tell you to text a certain amount to somewhere. So are campaign contributions somehow different?
Well, they are in a sense. I mean, it's a, you know, making contributions is a very regulated process in this country. So you've got concerns about, you know, is the contribution being made by someone who's a legal donor? In other words, is it someone who's, say, a U.S. citizen as opposed to a foreign citizen?
Mm-hmm.
And there are concerns about the contribution limits. You know, you have to make sure that even assuming it's a permissible donor, are they staying within their $2,500 per election contribution limit on giving to the candidate in question?
Is the Federal Election Commission capable of monitoring all of this and making sure that the law is being abided by?
Well, I mean, they obviously are not going to be able to audit each campaign that tries to use this kind of service. And that was part of their concern. This kind of request had come to them before in years past, and they had balked because they were a little bit unsure that there was an adequate set of protections built in so that they could feel, shall we say, fairly confident that the money coming in would be legal and clean and coming from the right kinds of sources. But, you know, the last go around, the folks who came and asked them this question, I think they finally were persuaded that there were enough protections built in that from their perspective, it would be okay to move forward.
So what's the big upside? I mean, why did the FEC like this? And why do both presidential candidates think it's a good idea?
Well, I mean, from the FEC's perspective, I think they always want to sort of be with the gang, if you will, and this is an idea that has been a long time in coming. I mean, these text messaging donations have been used in the charitable fundraising area for a long time, and campaigns have been waiting and waiting to be able to use this technique, and you know, there's a lot of money that's it's going to burst the dikes once this gets the green light and gets approved even by the phone company. And there's a lot of sort of small donor, so-called clean money that can move into the process.
It must seem like a totally different world of political donations now than when you were in charge.
Well, it has changed dramatically. I mean, the funny thing is, you know, it's so hard to get the law changed and updated just because of the gridlock on Capitol Hill. But, you know, they're still over at the FEC dealing with a statute that in many respects goes back to 1975. Some of the provisions in terms of record keeping haven't really been updated since that time frame. So, you know, a lot has come across. I mean, even faxes came across in terms of a way of communicating. And then computers and internet donations, if the FEC had to struggle to get approval for those. And so now here we are with the text-based donation technology. And at long last, they have reached a comfort level at the FEC to let it go.
I recall being warned about charitable donations via text message that some big chunk of that is skimmed off as kind of a service fee. Would that be the same for political contributions?
Well, sure. I mean, it's natural that all of the various entities that are in the process of making these transactions work are going to want to, you know, take their cut. They're in it not just for the good of it, but to make profit their businesses. So you're going to have the phone companies obviously have to get their service fee. And then these aggregators, the folks who are going to try to basically work with the phone companies and with the committees that are going to be getting what's left over, these aggregators have to get their share. So, yeah, the bottom line is there is going to be a fair amount of money sort of peeled away by the businesses that are in the pipeline. But, you know, for the net of it, the campaigns, they're still going to get some money out of it and more money than they would have had otherwise. So it's certainly in their interest to move forward with this if they can.
Scott Thomas is former FEC chairman, now with the law firm Dickstein Shapiro. Thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
In some other technology news now, we appear to have averted a prophesied mass internet outage today. According to the Wall Street Journal, internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon stepped up their game a little bit over the weekend to make sure customers could get online. But the threat that created this scare, something called click fraud, is still a real danger. Here's Marketplace's Queena Kim.
This story started last November when the FBI busted a ring of cyber criminals in Estonia. Jenny Scheer is a spokesperson for the FBI.
We call this case Operation Ghost Click.
This is how it worked. Cyber criminals hijacked ad space on a real website. The ads looked real, but when the victims clicked,
rather than the legitimate ad that was supposed to be on that webpage, there was an ad that the criminals wanted you to go to.
And the bad guys got paid for those clicks. It's called click fraud. The cyber criminals in Estonia made about $14 million from this scam. Cameron Camp is a researcher at ESET, an antivirus software firm. He says those big dollars are spawning copycats.
Click fraud in general is skyrocketing. Scammers are like any other kind of thief. A scam works once, they're going to do it again.
So if you click on an ad for a Home Depot sale, but end up at a site selling fake pharmaceuticals, there's a good chance you've been a victim of click fraud. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
Last Friday, we learned a little something about the state of the economy when the Labor Department told us that the unemployment rate remains at 8.2%. Tonight, HBO is going to put some faces on that number with a new documentary called Hard Times, Lost on Long Island.
I know how you feel when people tell you that. People that aren't unemployed and people that aren't going through this. Yeah, I know how you feel. No, you don't know how I feel. You're not out of work for a year. You're not trying to support it. You're working. You have a job. You don't know how I feel.
That's Alan Fromm, one of the unemployed Long Islanders featured in the film. We're joined now from Los Angeles by the film's producer and director, Mark Levin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with the location. That's one of the things that's pretty unique about this particular documentary about unemployment. You set it in this very picture-perfect 1950s American suburb.
That's right. And that was part of the idea. I mean, Levittown is famous for being kind of the birthplace for post-World War II American suburbia, the good life. And the whole concept here was to show and put a human face on the fallout of this Great Recession. So I thought, you know, Long Island, obviously this is a story that could be told in many places around this country. But I thought it made perfect sense to kind of build it around this birthplace of post-war suburbia.
One of the women that you focus on says, we all did what we were supposed to do, and this was the result for us. So sort of a message of it's not our fault, which a lot of people look at the unemployment problem and they say, you know, these people are not looking for work as they should be.
You're right. And what's amazing is how many of the people who've lost their jobs still internalize that message that it must be your fault. I'd have to say the most surprising reaction we've gotten in just some of the sneak previews of the film is people standing up in the audience and saying afterwards, I never had the courage to tell you what I'm going to tell you now. My sister is living in our basement, or my uncle is living in our attic and collecting disability, and we're living on his disability check. And I think that's part of the process, to be able to stand up and tell your story. That's kind of the first step.
Did you see any hope for the people that you spoke with?
As far as hope goes, I'm hoping that's the next stage. First was the realization of this is something, a new paradigm has to come up in terms of the social contract. If you do the right thing, if you work hard, if you're a responsible citizen in your community, the deal was, you know, you would have a secure and a good life. That deal seems to have fallen apart. What the new deal is, we don't know yet.
Mark Levin is the director and producer of the new HBO documentary, Hard Times, Lost on Long Island. It airs tonight. Thank you so much for talking with us.
I appreciate it. Have a good day.
It has been something of a wild ride for the world's stock exchanges the last few years. So why would anybody want to start a new exchange in this climate? Well, Cambodia's got one answer. The Southeast Asian country just recently launched its own stock market. Here's Nidhi Dhat in Phnom Penh.
This may be what you think of when you imagine the floor of a stock exchange. But thousands of miles from the frenzy of Wall Street, three stockbrokers sit patiently at their computers in Phnom Penh, their attentions focused on one stock. Yes, just one. Traders can buy a share in the state-owned Phnom Penh Water Supply Authority for around $1.50. It started trading in April, and so far, it's the only stock listed on Cambodia's brand new stock exchange. In Chani is the president of Aklita Bank. He says the ability to now buy shares is actually pretty exciting to Cambodians, because when their stock market opened last year, even that wasn't available. The market opened for business with no stocks.
People can place deposit with the bank, or they can invest in a large corporation.
A handful of other state-owned companies are planning their debut on Cambodia's stock exchange. They're expected to list alongside the Phnom Penh Water Supply Authority later this year. Scott Lewis is from Leopard Capital, a Phnom Penh-based private equity firm.
Yeah, I do find ironic that here in a country that experienced, you know, a brutal form of communism, that you actually, at a time where in the West people are questioning the capitalist system and free markets, that you have here, people have a much stronger faith and are excited about free markets and embracing capitalism.
It's a busy morning at this local food market in Phnom Penh. The average Cambodian earns less than $3 a day, and most of that is spent here on food and other basics. Few have money left over to invest in stocks. But as the economy grows, the trading floor of the world's newest stock exchange is sure to get busier. In Phnom Penh, Cambodia, I'm Nidhi Dutt for Marketplace.
So those of us like me, and I presume, Jeremy, we're not sitting in the same room, but I think you qualify as well. People who do not have hair extensions.
Yes, probably, that's true. I do not have hair extensions.
Probably have no idea what a serious investment these things are and how expensive they are. So it's not surprising then, maybe, that three robbers broke through a wall and did some sort of Mission Impossible type job of evading motion detectors to steal $230,000 worth of hair extensions.
Whoa.
In Chicago the other day. That amounted to about six duffel bags worth of hair. And the owner of this.
That's it.
It's valuable stuff, I guess.
Wow.
The owner of the salon thinks those extensions are going to be sold on the underground market. So I guess if you're walking down the sidewalk in Chicago and someone goes, hey, man, you want some hair?
They may have been stolen.
You know where it came from.
Well, finally, Jeff, the South Florida Sun Sentinel newspaper had some bad news this weekend for people with big ideas to stop hurricanes.
All right.
One of them is that dumping 100,000 tons of kitty litter into the water will not work. That will not stop a hurricane. or it wouldn't. It's just not practical.
It's not a good idea for lots of reasons.
I guess not. I know you think about the amount of cats that would come and be up next to the beaches and the Gulf. But also towing an iceberg into the path of a storm, that's not practical, according to the newspaper.
All right.
And they say nuking the hurricane would actually cause more problems than it solves, which is no big surprise, I guess. That, by the way, was one of the most frequent suggestions of how to stop a hurricane.
Some hard-hitting investigation from the South Florida Sun Sentinel there. Well, I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.